As college students across Illinois kick off their fall semesters, today we talk about how campuses are grappling with the issue of sexual assault.
We are becoming more aware of the problem and that victim survivors are becoming more willing to come forward.
That's Northwestern University law professor Deborah Turkheimer speaking on the school's Planet Lex podcast. She joins us today to talk about what we need to do to reduce the number of sexual assaults. Plus, Senator Mark Kirk over the weekend made headlines with his claim that President Obama is a drug dealer in chief. His opponent for his seat, Representative Tammy Duckworth, said yesterday in Champaign that the U.S. should be protecting Syrian civilians.
We're not a nation that turns our backs on children who are drowning in the Mediterranean. We're not a nation that turns our back on widows and orphans.
We'll talk more about what both said in our political roundup. And we delve into a Civil War love story that started in Peoria in the 1860s. That's all this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. School is back in session for many college students across Illinois. At the University of Illinois, move-in day was last Thursday. And the school year hadn't even officially started before news of the first reported case of sexual assault, that was of a female student at a fraternity house in Champaign, came early Friday morning. The issue of campus sexual assault was back in the spotlight earlier this year with the Stanford University rape case, which has again raised many questions about whether universities are doing enough to combat the problem. We're joined now by Deborah Turkheimer. She's a law professor at Northwestern University's Pritzker School of Law and joining us on the line from Evanston to talk about what campuses and how campuses should be grappling with this issue. Professor Turkheimer, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
As always, our phone lines are open and we'd like to hear from you as well. What do you think needs to change on college campuses to address the issue of sexual assault? Give us a call. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet your comments as well to 21st Show. Professor Turkheimer, your daughter Leah went off to college 2 years ago, and earlier this summer you wrote an article for the New York Times where you mentioned that all incoming freshmen in her class were required to take an online course on sexual assault prevention, which is pretty typical, I think, these days for most incoming freshmen. It must be an interesting perspective for you because this is something that you've covered as part of your legal expertise as a scholar, but I wonder how much more it also meant to you personally once your daughter became a college student?
Well, actually, that wasn't me with a daughter going off to college. My kids are younger, but you know, I can certainly speak to the importance of the kinds of prevention efforts that you're referring to, because I do think that they're sort of instrumental in changing the response that institutions of higher education have been putting forth. It's just not been enough, and we're seeing some really important changes.
Okay. And I know that when we look at the reports, we know that 1 in 5 women will be sexually assaulted during college. A study published by the Department of Justice says 4 out of 5 victims were raped by someone they knew. Do we think that sexual assault on campus, I don't know if it's becoming more common, do we feel that people are reporting it more now? Do we feel like this issue is coming out in the open a little bit more?
Right. I think it's mostly the latter. I think that sexual assault on campus has been a problem for a very long time. And for decades, we just were not aware of the scope of the problem. And that's in part because survivors of sexual assault weren't coming forward the way they are now. And that's in part because when survivors of sexual assault did come forward, their complaints were not treated properly, and I think only now are we beginning to realize how prevalent this problem really is.
In 2014, the Obama administration released a list of 55 colleges and universities that were under investigation at the time for their handling of sexual assault complaints. I know the University of Chicago was on that list. It's grown to now more than 300. And this is because the schools were on this list because someone brought a complaint to the Office of Civil Rights and the Department of Education. So I wanted to ask you, what is the university's legal responsibility, first of all, in handling sexual assault allegations from students?
Right. So Title IX is the statute that we're talking about and thinking about here. And it's been on the books for decades now, since 1972. But it's really evolved to cover the kind of conduct that we're talking about. it's a gender equity statute, and it requires that colleges, universities provide an educational environment that is equal to all students. When someone is sexually assaulted on campus, that equality is undermined, and schools have an obligation not only to prevent the occurrence of this sort of conduct to the greatest extent possible, but also to address it when it does occur.
And I know you're part of a group with the American Law Institute that's working to establish best practices for universities. What do you think are some of those best practices that universities need to have?
Well, you know, it really ranges from the very beginning when a complaint is made until the end, when a complaint is adjudicated and sanctions are imposed where that's appropriate. So at the very beginning, when someone comes forward and alleges some sort of, let's say, sexual assault, the university can do a lot as an interim measure, can help to ensure that this student is able to continue with his or her education. That can mean providing some sort of accommodation with respect to housing or dining or an exam schedule or perhaps a class schedule. It can involve counseling where appropriate. So there's a lot that can be done simply to support this person who comes forward and says, I was assaulted. And when it comes to sort of adjudicating, investigating, and adjudicating these cases, it's incredibly complicated. And I think we're only just now beginning to sort of grapple with what counts as a fair procedure in these kinds of cases.
Right. And so I think there's sort of two different parts of this, right? The legal responsibility versus sort of the moral responsibility. I wonder if we can talk about the legal responsibility for just a few more minutes before we shift to this other part. It doesn't seem like there's a standard practice for, is there a standard set of guidelines for how universities should be handling this?
Well, the Office of Civil Rights and the Department of Education has certainly issued detailed guidance on the subject, and that's been really useful, I think, for universities to the extent that they need to know what the government, the federal government, considers acceptable and what it considers unacceptable. So there's certainly a set of parameters out there that universities can look to sort of see what counts as compliance and what doesn't. At the same time, those guidelines, I think, only go so far, and there are a number of reasons why colleges and universities, I think, are looking for other kinds of guidance, and that's where the ALI project that you mentioned earlier comes into play. It's a project that looks at gender-based and sexual misconduct on campus, and the effort is to provide a set of best practices for kind of dealing with this problem. What kinds of procedures should colleges and universities implement in order to address this problem that we now all realize is real and is significant?
Mm-hmm. And I think that there's been so much of a push to discuss this publicly in the past few years, whether that's even President Obama or Vice President Biden, who was at U of I talking about this issue at one point. Celebrities have talked about their experiences. Do you think that even given all of that, it's still a very difficult conversation to have on campus to talk about sexual assault?
Yeah, I do. I think that this is evolving, and I think that we are seeing some progress, but by no means is the evolution complete. I think we've got a lot of work to do. I've been encouraged to see that this issue has stayed in the spotlight, and I think it's important that it remains in the spotlight. But yes, this is still very difficult, and we still see, I think, quite a bit of backlash when victims, survivors of sexual assault come forward and make these allegations.
I'm speaking with Deborah Turkheimer. She's a law professor at Northwestern University. We're talking about some recent stories that she's written in the New York Times about reforming rape policies on campus. We're also just talking about this issue in general. My question to those of you listening is, what needs to change on college campuses to prevent and stop sexual assaults from happening? Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. You can post to our Facebook page. You can tweet to 21st Show. We got a Facebook comment from Stephanie who said, and Professor Professor Turkheim, I wonder if you could address this. She says we need to remove campus security from the equation. That seems to be a step where things don't get reported to the city's police because schools don't want the numbers to affect them. What's your response to that?
I think campus security is not going to be removed from the equation, but I think that Stephanie, you know, certainly points to an important component of this conversation, which is the criminal justice system's response, right? And we should not forget that in many, though not all, of these cases, what is reported is not just a violation of the university's policies, but it's also a crime. And so while not all victims of sexual assault want to proceed with a criminal justice system process, that process should be in place and it should be functioning. And I think it's really important that we don't lose sight of the need to reform our criminal justice system so that it more effectively addresses these kinds of cases.
Well, and as you're talking about the criminal justice system, I wanted to shift the conversation a little bit also away from the legal conversation to the culture and changing culture. But in doing that, I did want to ask you kind of one more legal question, which is about consent, right? And I think we hear about freshmen who, you know, I mentioned that New York Times story earlier about they kind of that it's a very kind of a standard thing now, right? That college freshmen go to some sort of seminar where they are learning a little bit more about this. But this is obviously a really murky issue. And I wonder what the legal definition of consent is before we talk about culture change around consent.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a really excellent question and a difficult question to answer, because in each of the states, there's a separate criminal code, and each of those criminal codes defines, let's say, rape differently, and to the extent that rape involves consent, may define consent differently. So as we look across, you know, the 50 jurisdictions and the federal courts, we see lots and lots of variation in what counts as consent. Now, add to that the notion that on campus we've got these disciplinary codes that define the violation of sexual assault and maybe even what consent means. And that's where we've seen this move to affirmative consent definitions. And that's where we see this real change, I think a sea change, in how college students are being taught about what counts as consent.
And what does affirmative consent mean?
Yeah, so affirmative consent means that someone has to demonstrate a willingness to engage in sexual behavior, and passivity and silence without some sort of nonverbal conduct with it don't count as consent. It means that we've got to show that we want to engage in sexual conduct. And if we don't, if we're passive, if we're unconscious, if we're sleeping, that alone is not going to count as consent. And again, I think that's a really important cultural move for us to notice.
Right. And I think that gets to the point of President Obama and Vice President Biden's It's On Us campaign. That was 2 years ago, shifting the conversation instead of, and I think this is around this, right, instead of how can women be more careful, what do women need to do, to what men can do. And I wonder your thoughts on this. First of all, as we're discussing this, how important is it for us to be thinking about having conversations with young men and women about what all of this means?
It's very important. And I think that part of what we're seeing on campus with the kinds of educational programs that you mentioned earlier on in the show, you know, what we're seeing is a real attention to this idea that folks have to be attentive to what's going on when they're engaging in sexual conduct. It's not to say that people have to sign a contract. It's not to say that consent has to be given verbally, but it is to say that that people have to do something to show that they want to be involved in a sexual encounter. And I think that, you know, that's something that is coming out of this conversation about sexual assault that's really, really positive.
For parents of teenagers, what kind of conversations do you think they need to have with their children, both daughters and sons, before they go to school?
I think it's very much the same as what's happening when they get to college, obviously targeted to the appropriate age level and developmental level. But I think the core concept is exactly what we're talking about, right? That you don't do something to someone you really are involved in something that requires active and ongoing participation, and you've got to really take care when you're doing these sorts of things or other kinds of things that are not sexual. When you're talking to kids who are not thinking about sex but thinking about what it means to touch someone and what it means to take something from someone, you're going to be talking about the importance of securing consent, right?
Sure. Professor Turkerman, we just have about a minute left. And I just, as we're thinking about all of this, as you've talked about ALI and what the American Law Institute has done, as we've talked about best practices in both legal responsibilities as well as moral ones, what's my last question to you is, what else do you think universities need to be doing to help change this culture?
Well, I think as we've been talking about, the proactive cultural change is really important. Not putting this on women, not telling women what they need to do to prevent their assaults, but to really make this a community effort that aims to eradicate sexism on campus and racism on campus, and as a part of all of that, to really focus on sexual assault is something that everyone is implicated in and that everyone has a stake in preventing.
Deborah Turkheimer is a law professor at Northwestern University, where she teaches at the Pritzker School of Law. Professor Turkheimer, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
We wanted to point out that if you or someone you know is a victim of sexual assault, the number to call, the National Sexual Assault Hotline, is 1-800-656-HOPE. That's 1-800-656-HOPE. That's a 24-hour free confidential hotline. When you call that, they'll refer you to a local provider in your area. You're listening to The 21st. Nyla Boodoo, and you're listening to The 21st. More than 150 years ago, a 27-year-old Irish immigrant who would go on to become captain of the 17th Illinois Infantry in the Civil War fell in love with a 19-year-old young woman who was from one of Peoria's most prominent families. Their love story, in their own words, is recounted in A Civil War Captain and His Lady, a true story of love, courtship, and combat. Author Gene Barr is touring all across central Illinois this week to talk about it. He's speaking at 7 o'clock tonight at the Illinois State Military Museum in Springfield. He's speaking tomorrow evening in Champaign at the Barnes & Nobles, and on Thursday night at the North Branch of the Peoria Library. And he's in studio with me now in our Champaign-Urbana studios. Gene, welcome to The 21st. Thanks
Great
for being
to
here.
Be here.
And
Thank
welcome
you for
to Illinois.
Invite.
Welcome back to Illinois.
Welcome back.
Say.
It's been a few years, yes.
Now, this book is based on 75 letters between Josiah and Jenny. How rare is it to have Civil War-era correspondence where you have both sides?
That's extremely rare, Nyla. Now, there's a lot of cases where soldier letters, it's not uncommon to find them. It's great to find them because they're a great source of information, but it's very rare to have the letters from home to the soldier because they had typically no way of keeping them. They're out, it's exposed to the elements, they're marching, they're fighting, and they're very worried about being captured and having these personal effects taken from them.
Well, and this correspondence is over multiple years, so we get almost the first one from right when he goes off to fight through, it's 1865-ish, right?
Well, he served 3 years.
3 years.
He opted not to re-up, as many of
64
the others
then,
did,
right.
Correct. So he ended in about June of 64. So the letters span the period of time from June, July, 61 through that year, all of 62, all of 63, and Josiah's letters to Jenny are there for 64, but there are no letters that currently exist from her, and I speculate in the book about why that is. I have my own reasons for that.
Before we get to that, how did you find these letters?
It's a great story. Years ago, 16 years ago, a former colleague had inherited a cabin on a lake in Wisconsin, and these letters were there, and he asked me to sell them for him. And once I took a look at them and realized what they were, that is very rare Victorian courtship during the Civil War period, I realized I couldn't sell them, I couldn't break them up, because that story would be lost forever. So I made the decision to keep them, to keep the story together. That developed into a book.
16 years, this book is
yes.
in the making. I want to ask you a question, though, about those letters, because oftentimes when we see letters, people who are buying these or Civil War buffs are really only interested in just the soldier story, not the woman's side.
That's correct. And that's, I think this is a book that people can read for a number of different reasons. If you want to know more about social etiquette, mores of the time, you can read the book. If you just want a love story, a story of a courtship, you can do that. If you want to learn more about Fort Donelson, Henry, Shiloh, Vicksburg, Meridian, you can do that as well. There are many, many things in here. If you want to know what Illinois was like in 1860 through 1865, this is another great way of finding out.
Well, I'm going to ask you about all of that. Let's start with the Civil War part of this, right? Because the story starts in Monmouth in 1861. And I wanted to ask, what was Illinois' role in supplying troops in the Civil War?
They were one of the largest suppliers. Of course, the largest was, I believe, New York, followed by Pennsylvania. Illinois still at that time was considered almost the frontier. This was west of Pennsylvania, was considered the Western theater. So it wasn't quite as developed. But Illinois still sent a lot of troops in, including some troops east. There were some Illinois cavalry troops that fought at Gettysburg. But most of Illinois' troops fought in the battles out here, which unfortunately don't get as much attention. But a battle like Vicksburg was very much as important a turning point in the war as the battle at Gettysburg. So Illinois troops played a significant part in the battles in this part. And, of course, as we've noted, there's a lot of conflict here in Illinois over the views of the war during the people of the time.
Well, and you see that in the story of Josiah and Jenny even. But can we start by asking why? We don't exactly know, and you write that you don't exactly know why Josiah Moore enlisted. But can you guess?
You know, I think at the time there was such this rush in 1861 and this push that the Union's under attack. And despite the fact that for years there was this assumption that men joined to end slavery, unfortunately they didn't. In most cases, they said, the Union's under attack. Our dearly beloved country's under attack. I'm going to go take care of it, and I'm going to go fight. So Josiah was probably one of those, even though he wasn't born in this country, came to the country as an infant. That was what motivated people more than anything else. And to be honest, there was a real peer pressure when everyone around you, he's a student at Monmouth, your fellow students are enlisting. There's this tremendous peer pressure to enlist as well.
Well, he also had some really interesting views about John Brown and the abolitionist movement prior to the war that you uncovered.
He did. I found this student newspaper from Westminster College. It was actually a prep school, and it's out in the Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania area. He wrote this scathing, what I call scathing indictment of those involved with John Brown, who, for your listeners, was involved in the assault on Harper's Ferry in 1859 and was hanged. And he's viewed by many in very different ways. You know, John Brown is viewed, but those who are adamantly opposed to slavery viewed him certainly as a martyr in the cause, and Josiah certainly seemed to indicate that as well.
What do we know about Josiah's regiment, the 17th Illinois Infantry?
They're one of the earliest groups who enlisted. Of course, the lower the number, that means the earlier you went into the war. They were from the Company F, which was he was in, was from Monmouth. But the 17th itself was compiled of a number of different places. Peoria had a couple of different companies there. Company was about 100 men in the Civil War. You'd put 10 companies together to come up with 1,000. So 17th was roughly 1,000 men, though it was slightly under that because they tossed a couple for medical reasons. You had to have at least two teeth during the Civil War to chew
Just
off
two.
The cartridge. That's
Great.
Right. They had to be opposite because it didn't work the other way. So they were from a number of different counties across Illinois. So they put them together and formed the 17th.
It was interesting to me as I was reading this. I wanted to ask you how the regiments were funded, because I think when we learn about Civil War history, we have the blue and the gray, and we think everybody was in these uniforms and they all had proper weapons. That wasn't necessarily
the
case at all.
I mean, we had an extremely small standing army at the time, which that goes back to colonial times when there was this great distrust of standing armies. So there was not a lot to equip these guys. So sometimes the states would put money. The federal government had very little money. Sometimes the towns themselves, as was happening here, the guys from Monmouth got shipped off to Peoria. They were put in cattle stalls without proper blankets, so the people raised money to send them. And the concept of blue versus gray, particularly early in the war, was anything but true. You had guys coming in red uniforms, and some of the Union side wore gray uniforms, and some of the Confederate side wore blue uniforms. Some of that goes back to these militia. So it was this conglomerate of uniforms and hat styles and all kinds of what looked like French uniforms, Zouave at the time. So, yeah, it was not blue versus gray, certainly.
I'm speaking with Gene Barr. He's the author of A Civil War Captain and His Lady, Love, Courtship, and Combat from Fort Donelson Through the Vicksburg Campaign. He's on tour this week throughout central Illinois talking about this story. And that brings us to the love story portion of this. And you mentioned Josiah Moore ends up in Peoria. What was Peoria like in the 1850s?
Really good question. And for me, because again, coming from the East, people in the East get fixated on the battles like Gettysburg and Antietam, we don't really focus on here. But Peoria during the time was a very interesting place. It was kind of a mixture of people who supported the Union versus those who were very skeptical of what the Union was attempting to do. And the further south you went in Illinois, the more there was a pro-Southern sentiment. The further north you went, the more it was pro-Northern. A lot of immigrants in the north and a lot of transplanted Southerners in the south. So there was a real conflict here in terms of how this state viewed that effort. Parts of it wanted to secede from Illinois over this. So it was a very interesting place, and rampant talk of real danger. I mean, the governor at the time, Governor Yates, said that secessionism and views of the South were rampant and widespread throughout Illinois.
That said, Josiah Moore meets Jenny Lindsay as before he gets sent off. We don't really know how they met.
We don't, but I speculate a bit because from some of the research I've done, apparently her home was adjacent to the camp where they lived. So, and it was improper in the time, considered rude to walk up and introduce yourself to somebody, to a member of the opposite sex. You couldn't do that. So Josiah, in order to meet her, had to find somebody who knew her and ask for that introduction. Everything was very formal during the time. She had to agree to accept letters from him. So somehow, somewhere along the way, perhaps she was touring the camp with her father, who was a prominent citizen of Peoria during the time. So there's a lot of speculation about how it could have happened, but it's obvious that they met at some point and an attraction developed because he invited her and her family to some of the going-away parties that the regiment threw in Peoria before they left.
So there must have been part of the social scene in Peoria during this time where the people in the town were entertaining and also helping to support the soldiers as they were training and being ready to go off.
Exactly. And that's a great point, because when you look at all the letters over the years, Josiah continually references, how is Mr. So-and-so? How is Mrs. So-and-so? So you're right. There was this attitude in the town, despite the fact that Peoria was conflicted, of many people who supported the Union, felt strongly that they needed to provide some kind of support to the Union troops that were in town, and it's obvious that there was a lot of interaction between the troops and many of the Peoria citizens.
So we get to their courtship, which I have to say is a little painstaking, but I think
yes,
that's where Victorian comes in, right?
Absolutely.
And I wonder if you can describe to people who are not familiar with this time period, when we say courtship, what that really means.
Well, you know, people courted through letters. This was an educational experience for me, too, because we're all here. You know, we grew up in the 20th century. There was a certain way of doing it then, and they had a distinctly different way of doing it. And you
well, there's no overt displays of affection.
None.
You can see they're very careful. She calls him friend.
Yes. But
it maybe was
later.
A big thing to
yes.
even say friend.
It was friend, and then it became dearly beloved, and then it develops, which is, in my view, I think one of the really interesting parts of the letters. You see the courtship and the relationship develop through the letters, not because we can't see them directly, but you see it because the language changes on both of them. Particularly early on, Josiah is very matter of fact. And at one point, I think it's early 1862, he hadn't written for a while, and it almost became like a little junior high play.
That's where she gets her friend to intercede.
She gets her friend, who's her cousin, to say, how come you're not writing
and
to Jenny?
And he writes her, right.
And
yeah.
Then
so
he writes
her. And you found that letter, too.
And I found I own all of them, and it was very interesting. It literally was like, you know, one of these junior high school type things. How come you're not talking to Jenny anymore? And it was really funny to read some of these.
I wonder how it changed what's sort of the most striking thing to you about how courtship occurred 150 years ago?
I didn't know how structured and formal that it was. I really didn't. I knew that the Victorians were certainly much more formal and structured than we are today, but I didn't realize how much that extended, because there had to be so much consent given in terms of, you know, am I allowed to write you? You couldn't presume as a man to be able, you could just send this letter to this young woman. You had to ask her permission. Would she take it? And then you could exchange photographs, much like we do for schools. They're called CDVs, or having carte de visite. So they would exchange those as well. It was a very refined, formal, structured process.
And their language is so flowery. There's a lot of these and thous in this. Did people speak that way?
I wouldn't think that they would speak that way. But of course, the level and the intelligence displayed in your letters reflected on you at the time. That was made perfectly clear to people of the time. And in the letters, you'll see Jenny, and to a certain degree, Josiah, apologize for the letters. I don't think this one's up to par. I'm sorry, you're reading my poor missive. And they're continually apologizing for failing to meet what they believe to be standards of the time.
Well, and she's quite young compared to, I mean, she's 19, and I guess 19 in a Civil War era is very different from a 19-year-old today.
Yes.
But he's 27. Certainly, she's a very well-educated young woman, and she's, I mean, they have really interesting there's politics, they're talking about their political beliefs. Like, it's a really interesting discourse that happens over
time.
It's
all of that. And what I found interesting is looking at the letters is like looking through a prism at all of the thoughts of the day, whether it's religion or what's going on the home front or politics or why men fought. Or you could see at certain points, particularly with Josiah and with Jenny, their optimism over the war flagging a bit. When you go through things, particularly some of the events in the East where things weren't going well at all from the war, and even in early 1863 when the war for the Union was really almost at its depths, you had these men dying in swamps and around Vicksburg. And you could see his optimism flagging, wondering if he's doing the right thing, and she continually imploring him, can't you come home? Can't you come home? And it gets to be very intriguing side of it, as you see, that things weren't always going very well for the Union.
Your day job is not a historian, but you're clearly a Civil War buff. Why did you want to write this book?
You know, when when I saw these letters and I realized what it was, I realized that it was a tremendous story, and I thought an illumination of this part of American history, and I just couldn't let it go. And I just made the decision that I had to progress with this and that this story ought to be told. And I just decided, because as you note, I've had a long-standing interest in Civil War history, it's kind of, boy, it'd be neat to write a book. Well, I just was very lucky to have these fall into my lap, and I wrote a book.
So this week you're going to be in Peoria, you're in Springfield tonight, you're going to be sort of all around the area where they were. I guess we should give away the end of the story and say that Jenny and Josiah did get married. So
yeah,
we're going to give that away for everybody. That's
here.
My spoiler.
We can do a little bit of that.
But their descendants did they know about you writing the book?
There was one I ran into there. I wound up connecting with their great-great-grandson who was tremendously helpful to me. And I know that they still have a son. Their son is in Ohio, and I believe there's another brother. I don't know if there's others here, too. Unfortunately, their one great-grandson, David Jupe, passed away in October, and he had a tremendous interest in having the story told, and it's unfortunate David was not able to see the completion of the project, but he was greatly helpful to me during the process.
I wonder this week if maybe we'll encounter descendants of the people that you write about in this
book. You know, I would love to see that. In fact, I want to mention a lot of the names of the people there, and hopefully when we're in here in these various places in Peoria and in some of the other places that perhaps some of them will say, hey, that was my great-great uncle or something like that. That would be wonderful.
Do you think historians in the future will look back now at all, thinking about all of our social media correspondence and text messages and how
we
did
that?
How we would do that, right?
Would certainly change it. I know they're certainly written differently, nowhere near as flowery. I just don't see many these and thous in text messages these days. I'm not quite sure how that would work.
Well, Gene Barr, as I mentioned, is touring all across Central Illinois this week. He's speaking at 7 o'clock tonight at the Illinois State Military Museum in Springfield. He's speaking tomorrow evening at the Barnes & Noble in Champaign. He's speaking Thursday night at the North Branch of the Peoria Library. You've got a couple other ones
there. We're up
in
Monmouth on Wednesday night. Yes.
All right. The book is called A Civil War Captain and His Lady, Love, Courtship, and Combat from Fort Donelson through the Vicksburg Campaign. Gene, thank you for being with me.
Thank you for the invitation. Enjoy talking.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Illinois Senator Mark Kirk compares the president to the drug dealer in chief, Vendors say the state fair was a disaster. Democrats are meeting to pick presidential electors, and the governor is signing a bill to cut the price of prison phone calls. On Monday, we talk state politics. With us today, Illinois Public Radio State House Bureau Chief Amanda Vinicky. She's on the phone from Springfield, and Brian Mackey in our studio at our 21st partner station, WUIS, where he covers state government and politics. Hey, guys.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Senator Mark Kirk is in a competitive race to hold on to his Senate seat. He's running against Tammy Duckworth, a Democrat. In an interview last week, Senator Kirk referred to President Obama as the drug dealer in chief. That came out this weekend with the State Journal Register reporting that. Today, he's been tweeting about holding Senate congressional hearings over this. Brian, can you explain his comment in context and give us the background here? What's this all about?
Yeah, I'm actually going to defer to Amanda on this one, if I can.
Amanda?
Yeah, and actually, so this is not a story that I cover. We did see Kirk when he was here last week at the Illinois State Fairgrounds, and he did not make those particular comments, but this is in regard to the release of American prisoners from Iran, where he has basically said that Obama is a drug dealer in chief, that this was sort of, you know, ransom money. Kirk is not the only Republican who has trying to make a big issue out of this. Again, this kind of came out after we in Springfield last saw Senator Kirk.
Right. So and so it was the 500.
Emails, really.
Yeah. So there was right. So there was the $500 million that that was meant, actually, I think this was tied originally back to, was owed back, I think, from 1979 to Iran.
Right.
And then the Obama administration has said, I know that it was used as, quote, leverage in this release. Now, I guess my question, Amanda, for you is, we know that Senator Kirk chairs the Senate Subcommittee on National Security and International Trade and Finance. And I wonder, in a tactical sense, during a campaign year, as he's in the past sort of not only he's so now not only has he not denied that he said this, he's sort of upped the ante, right? And we're getting lots of emails about how he's going to start holding hearings. He's been very active talking about that today. I wonder if you think, in a tactical sense, how much this issue could help or hurt Senator Kirk with voters. Amanda?
You know, I think it's definitely going to play a role, because national security is high on everybody's list. And clearly, we wouldn't see Kirk going all out on this were it not something that he believed would resonate with voters. Nonetheless, I think that you have plenty of voters that are more concerned with domestic issues. And so for them, that will be a priority. Really, this is kind of one of the first times that we're seeing actual policy come up in this Senate bid, though we haven't had any, you know, real debate with this. It is still very, I think, political in nature when you read these press releases. And in fact, Democrats, of course, coming to Tammy Duckworth, Kirk's opponent's defense, saying that for Kirk to say that she's not tough on national security is a kind of an offensive notion, given her past and her experience serving in the National Guard. And of course, that's how she came to, you know, lose her legs in a helicopter accident. They're saying that she knows and, in fact, has a credible reputation in Washington for that. So I think that we're going to continue to see this. And in fact, every time you turn on your commercial or turn on your TV,
yeah, there's those commercials.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, and I was going to say, Congressman Duckworth, she was making campaign stops yesterday in Danville and Champaign. She was asked about that photo of a 5-year-old Syrian boy who was hurt in the fighting, the photo that everyone's, it's not just that screen image that everyone keeps seeing of that poor little boy covered in dust and rubble. And I just wanted to play what she said yesterday in Champaign, because she says the country can't turn its back on victims of violence.
We could potentially create a dialogue out there that America does not care about the victims of violence, and that could turn, you know, opinion against us. And I, you know, we're not a nation to turn our backs on children who are drowning in the Mediterranean. We're not a nation that turns our back on widows and orphans.
To be clear, she also said that she thinks there needs to be a better international coalition, that the U.S. needs to be working more with other countries to help Syrian civilians. Brian, Amanda, either one of you jump in here. Are we getting to the point in the campaign now where we maybe actually will be talking about more substantive issues? Because it seems like right now this is maybe the first time we've had actual policy discussions.
I doubt it, unless events continue to force the candidates to talk about substantive issues. They'd rather not talk about substantive issues. They'd rather talk about things that will gin up members of their particular demographics that they're targeting and, you know, say as little as possible otherwise. I mean, that's pretty typical in campaigns, and I think this one has been a particularly terrible but textbook example of how to run a mostly substance-free, image-based campaign, you know, where you're just attacking the rhetoric of the other side as much as you can without really committing yourself or getting in-depth on policy discussions.
A lot of this came up during the state fair, and let's switch the conversation to that, Amanda, because their state fair is traditionally lots of politics. You were here last Monday to sort of set the scene of how the week was going to go. Can you give us a summation of the politics that happened at the state fair, Amanda, before we get on to all the other issues that we heard about with the state fair?
Yeah, so it's interesting, Nyla. Actually, the state fair used to be thought of as the start to the campaign season, the kickoff. And we have definitely seen a change in that because, in part, with just social media and also with the huge amounts of money that are pouring into races all over the place, the big significance of the U.S. Senate race in Illinois, given the ramifications that that could hold for control of the U.S. Senate. And particularly when I talk money, I mean Governor Bruce Rauner's money that he's been pouring in. So there have been commercials airing for months and throughout the summer, no longer really the traditional kickoff, but most certainly a time for politicians that are running for office to get a big bang downstate. There are often, particularly statewide candidates, focused in the Chicago media market where you have the most voters. But this is a place where they can, you know, come down and you have really the bulk of the state's political press corps all there waiting, reporting on their speech. And what you saw both parties trying to do was a bit of a blame game. You had the Republicans spending their day denouncing the quote-unquote machine, namely meaning House Speaker Michael Madigan, and trying to tie any and every Democratic candidate to him, hoping that the Madigan name is unpopular enough that it will bring down other Democrats. And then on the reverse side, you saw Democrats spending their day bringing up Donald Trump. You barely heard the name Trump muttered during the GOP day at the fair. Democrats did it the whole way through, trying to tie both Trump and Rauner, who is not polling very well when it comes to favorability polls, to any Republican down ballot.
Brian, any political standouts of the week from the state fair for you?
No, I think Amanda had a pretty good summation there. I think we just saw a preview of what the fall campaigns are going to look like. If you're on the Republican side, it's all going to be about House Speaker Michael Madigan. And if you're on the Democratic side, it's going to be the Trump-Rauner Mark Kirk agenda, or the Trump Rauner insert name of candidate here agenda, just trying to tie them back to the deeply unpopular figures at the top of the ticket. Of course, that's a bit of a misnomer, what I just said at the top of the ticket, because Michael Madigan is not at the top of the ticket. And although there's been a lot of money spent on advertising to try and, emphasize his unpopularity in a lot of these local races, only one out of 118 Illinois representative districts get to cast an actual ballot for or against Mike Madigan. So it remains to be seen. It's a strategy that's been tried in the past, of course, without the millions and millions of dollars that Governor Rauner is bringing to the table this time. So it remains to be seen whether that can be successful.
Sure. Go ahead, Amanda.
I'm sorry, Brian. I didn't mean to step over you there, but I did want to just get in. I think one kind of interesting takeaway is in a race that hasn't gotten really much attention at all, given the others of significance, is the special election for comptroller. And that is where the woman appointed by Governor Bruce Rauner following the death of Judy Bartopinka, Leslie Munger, who's serving in that office now, trying to hold on to it, running against a former state representative and current Chicago City Clerk, Susana Mendoza. And that was a race where, as Brian noted, we saw a preview, really, of what the campaign is going to be going forward. And it is part of that Munger trying to tie Mendoza to Madigan, and then the reverse, Mendoza trying to tie Munger to Bruce Rauner. But it took on some extra significance.
Yeah, I was going to. Can I do a math? Can I ask you guys? Can I ask you an impromptu math question here?
No, no math quizzes here. But you know what? I'm not running for comptroller. I think that was part of the.
Can you explain for everyone who hasn't heard about the multiplication tables what we're talking about, Amanda?
Yeah, but of course. So you had On the governor's Republican day, which comes first, Comptroller Leslie Munger trying to make an issue about her opponent, saying she never talks about math, doesn't talk about the budget, doesn't know math, and is really just there. She made the accusation because of the speaker and also Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel, basically trying to say Susana Mendoza got there through the help of these guys. Mendoza, the next day, said, "That's sexist. I've won election all on my own, and then I do know math." And she proved it, actually. The Chicago Tribune brought down a videographer, and their reporter asked both Munger and Mendoza
That's Kim Jansen,
for a
right,
bit of a math
right.
quiz.
He just said, pop quiz, what's 7 times 8, I think.
Exactly. And, of course, the answer is 56. Munger eventually got there, but flubbed a bit.
It took me a minute this morning, I have to say, when I was sitting there thinking. I was like, I know it's before I've had my tea, but it's taken me a minute, too. But
in fairness, that is one of the most difficult positions on the multiplication table.
Yeah, she didn't do a 7 times 7. But, I mean, I guess the question is, how much does this become a moment? Or I wonder what
this becomes a campaign commercial. I think it is.
Well, it's already a fundraising moment for Mendoza, correct? Right? She's asking people to raise $56 for her.
You better believe it. A fundraising moment, again, like I said, I mean, you're going to see that as a campaign commercial very much. There's a lot that goes into this. Of course, you're going to have presumably a lot of Rauner money helping Munger. You're going to have the tide of the presidential race falling down ballot is the conventional wisdom. But I definitely think that this is going to be something that resonates with people because they get it. Again, as we talked about in the beginning, some of the Iran issues, there are definitely people that are following that, and each of the party's bases, given all that has gone on with Syrian refugees and such this year, that care and are following it. But there's just going to be, this will be a campaign commercial that people will understand, will probably remember when they go to the ballot box.
Brian, do you think our comptroller to be able to know her multiplication tables?
I guess we want everyone to be able to know our multiplication tables, but I do think it is worth the moment. And Amanda's right. That's not to say that it's not going to be something that's memorable. And this is, you know, sort of like when Rick Perry, the governor of Texas, had that presidential debate moment where he wanted to eliminate 3 federal agencies, the so-and-so, and just couldn't come up with
right.
the third one. But
it doesn't
really
mean that
the controller is not necessarily right. there. I hope the controller is not sitting there with a calculator and pencil. All day
Illinois has bigger problems than we thought they did.
This is an executive office. There are many, many smart accountants and people who are hired to do those jobs. This is a political job where you supervise a staff. So from just a brief dispatch from the reality-based community, I don't know that not knowing, when you're sort of jumped by a reporter to say, what is 7 times 8? Does that really make you a terrible controller? Not necessarily, but it certainly is memorable.
She was an executive of a major corporation, Helene Curtis. She was a top executive there. So I think Leslie Munger could say plenty in her defense. But as Brian noted, does it mean anything? Not necessarily. Will it mean something when it comes to the election? Probably.
Really quickly, Amanda, you talked to Chicago City Treasurer Kurt Summers last week around speculation about who's going to be running for the Democratic side of governor in 2 years. He didn't say no to you.
He did not say no. And in fact, reports or kind of the inside word is that it was his team that floated his name. He didn't confirm it, but you can take away from it that he didn't say no. He also tried to play up his downstate roots, saying that he had served as an intern in Springfield, had a lot of family who'd graduated from actually University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, so it was often there. His wife went to SIU down in Carbondale. So it certainly seemed as if he was open to the possibility. It could just be that he's trying to raise his profile. The wisdom has been that he would be in contention for Chicago's next mayor. So we will see a lot of names being floated out there, and I think people really looking to see what Dick Durbin does.
Just less than a minute left, Amanda. Governor Rauner was in Chicago in the last hour to sign a series of bills on criminal justice issues. Can you just tell us quickly what he's did today and then over the weekend, the couple bills he signed?
Well, kind of, because actually as that Chicago event was taking place, I was covering the Democratic State Central Committee voting for who will be their presidential electors when it
right.
comes to the Electoral
College. So lots
college.
Going
so
on.
Unfortunately, I missed the bill signings that the governor did this morning and just got back and called you, so haven't even seen what he did. Brian, I don't know if you were able to.
I can just briefly sort of say, I mean, this is just, there's a number of pretty low-hanging fruit here, and on the great spectrum of criminal justice reform, there are some things that require a certain type of report, a pre-sentencing report for juvenile people who might be sentenced to a state detention facility, a number of pretty small things like that. Another one addresses the rate of phone calls that inmates in the Department of Corrections and Department of Juvenile Justice have to pay for. There have been a number of stories about really exorbitant charges for making phone calls from prisons by for-profit companies.
Yeah, so we'll have thanks for that. Yeah. We'll have more on that later if folks tune in to All Things Considered on that. I want to thank Brian Mackey from WUIS, Amanda Vinicky from IPR for joining us. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking about the business of craft beer, and we want to know from you, what's your favorite craft beer? Post to our Facebook page. Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo.